My name's Dwayne. I'm an alcoholic, and it's real good to be here. And I want to thank Billy for those responsible for asking me to come down. And but I really want to thank Billy. Billy's spirit has just been a welcoming spirit. I mean, he made me feel welcome. I came down last year, and I spoke at a meeting in Madison, and y'all invited me back. And but I felt welcome when I came down, and I was telling my friend we had a good trip, and it's been a good trip today. My home group is a cosmopolitan group. The history of that group is in the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous, Jim's Story. If you get a chance, you can check that out, Jim's Story. It's the first black group in Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's a lot of history with that. I got a sponsor. My anniversary date is February of 76. I was 23 years old when I got here. I was a do-nothing drunk. I ended up in a place called Men's Detox. Detox was a place where they brought you where you were drunk on the street, smell of urine, vomit, just people didn't bathe in a long time. Thank God for detox. Thank God for it. Thank God for it. I tried to stop drinking on my own. I'm one of those that this thing hit me hard early in the game. We get here at different times, maybe different circumstances. But for me, it hit me hard early in the game. I started drinking at the age of 15. And I think I took the drink out of curiosity. It was always alcohol in my house, or my parents drank. They drank that old granddad 100 proof. And I said, I'm going to see what this stuff is about, because there was just so much activity surrounding the drink. And when I took that drink, and I've heard different people describe that first drink. I like what Joyce and Joyce, I really got a lot out of Joyce and Merv. I got a lot out of both of them. And but Joyce, I see her in D.C., in the D.C. area. Sometimes I go to her home group every now and then. And sometimes she comes to mind. But I like what she said about that first drink. But I heard a guy describe that first drink. He said it was like a magic potion. And I could relate to that. I was a guy that was full of a lot of fear. And I didn't understand it at the time. All I knew at the time was when I took the drink, it made me feel good. That's all I knew then. But I understand it a lot better now. I knew that when I took the drink, the fears went away. I'm a guy that was always concerned about how people saw me. But I remember when I took that drink and I went outside and I had this big grin on my face. And people seemed like it wouldn't go away. You know, I mean, it was just stuck there. And people were looking at me kind of strange, you know. And I didn't care. And that was one of the attractions that I had with alcohol. When I drank, I didn't care what you thought. You know, that was one of the attractions that I had. But I had problems with it really early. I would drink and go to school. And I'm one of those that I had problems long before I picked up a drink. You know, I stayed back in the second grade. I don't know how you stay back in the second grade, but that's an indication you got some problems right then. And those problems were to follow me all through. I was to eventually drop out in the ninth grade because by that time I'm drinking. But I would drink and I would go to school and I would just check in. Sometimes I would just go to school in the morning, check in, hook up with some people, we leave, go over to somebody's house and we drink. And but I remember this teacher, this man tried to help me. I hadn't been drinking but a couple of months. And one day this teacher said he had something for me. And he gave me a book on alcoholism. And I resented that. You know, I just got started drinking. I'm only 15 years old. And he gives me a book on alcoholism. Because, see, I associated alcoholism with someone, you know, in the city, standing on a corner, drinking wine, bumming money, that kind of thing. I couldn't see myself as being an alcoholic or even having a problem with alcohol. But he gave me the book because I was coming to his classroom drunk. And he tried to help me. The other teachers told me don't come back like that anymore. And what happened was at the end of that same school year, I stayed back again. And I got drunk that last day of school and ran into one of my friends. And they said, look, why don't you go down there and talk to the teacher? Maybe they'll change your grade. But when I'm drinking, there aren't any rational conversations. I end up telling people what to do. They described the type of drunk that I was in the big book as Jekyll and Hyde. You know, when I wasn't drinking, I could act for life. My parents tried to teach me some values. You know, they tried to do some things for me. And I could act polite to them. How you doing, Miss So-and-so? You know, talk nice to the neighbors and that type of thing. But the literature talks about we get insanely drunk. And that's what I would do. And that same man that gave me that book on alcoholism, I went to his classroom. I told him he should have passed me. He told me to get out. I wouldn't leave. And it turned into a physical fight. And it wasn't much of a fight. He beat me up, threw me down the steps. They called my mother down there, and they were trying to talk to me. But again, when I'm drinking, I don't listen to anybody. I start running my mouth. But the man knew that I was sick. He knew I was sick. He didn't press any charges, and he let me go. But that's what happened in my first few months, my first year drinking. It was just like that. I would steal my parents' liquor. And in the beginning, I got away with that for a while because my tolerance wasn't that high. But the more I drank, my tolerance got higher. They would say, well, who's drinking the liquor? And I lied. Now, that was another one of my problems. I was a liar long before I started drinking. But my lying and my stealing progress is my drinking progress. So I would always lie, not me, not me. And so then they started, I started pouring water in it. And, you know, I got away with that for a minute till you know what happened. I started pouring so much water, and now they mad because I'm messing up the liquor. And who's pouring water in the liquor? And I said, well, it's not me. And so then they started hiding it. And, you know, it might be behind the zinc or something like that, you know, and I always find it. And then they had to start taking it to work with them in the morning. So now I'm a guy that I'd wake up in the morning, I'd drink in the morning. So I'd get up and watch and see if they went out to the car with a bag. If there was no bag, if they didn't take a bag out, that meant there was something in the house. And I'd tear up the house that I found that bottle. And this old granddad, 100 proof, I drink that stuff straight out of the bottle. I was never a sociable drinker. You know, I wanted to get drunk, pretty much. You know, I was drinking for the effect. That's why I was drinking. And but I started having problems early, and like I said, I dropped out of school in the ninth grade. I get these little jobs since I didn't have any education in these government buildings, cleaning up or washing dishes or something like that. I drink before I got to the job. I know the bootlegger because back then they would always have a bootlegger in one of them government buildings. I drink on the job and drink when I, you know, got off. So consequently, I couldn't hold a job. My father, he used to take me to work. He would take me. And I would go in one door and I'd call in from upstairs. You know, I'd call in from upstairs and leave right out of the place. You know what I mean? Because I wanted to go back home and drink. That mental obsession to alcohol was real strong with me. I went to a treatment program in my teens, but I wasn't ready to stop. The police picked me up. They knew what I was doing, but they knew I was early in the game, and they were trying to help me. They told me, if you go into the program, we won't lock you up. I went to the program, but they weren't really monitoring me, and I wasn't ready to stop, so I left. But it wasn't long after that I started checking into places. I started going to places like emergency rooms and to get a quick fix, because I'm one of these kind of guys, I'll drink to the point that I become physically addicted to alcohol. Go through DTs, but I don't get a drink. Start shaking, trembling, hearing things. And I was doing so bad. I mean, towards the end, I was doing real bad. And I remember I called broke most of the time. All my money was going into alcohol. And I remember I called, I was going through some problems, issues. And I called didn't have any money. I called the ambulance, so I figured they'd come out. So I told them, I said, well, look, I'm getting ready to kill myself. I figured they'd come on out and get me, you know, because I didn't have no money to go to the hospital. They said, well, look, you just catch the bus on over here, and we'll help you, you know, when you get here. But, you know, one of the things that happened with that experience that I started realizing maybe just a few years ago was how just going into the emergency room, and even though I wasn't ready to stop, because, you know, when you going in there in the condition that I would go, they're not going to treat it like an emergency. They're going to make you wait for a long time. And but it just seemed like I can remember how just sitting there sometimes, because I just made that small attempt to ask for some help, that I would kind of calm down a little bit. Because, see, I'm a guy that really wouldn't ask anybody for any help. I came out of a family, they tried to help me. They tried to help me. But my parents, you know, my father was from North Carolina. He was the oldest of seven. And he didn't really get any guidance. So he didn't really, he couldn't pass on something that he didn't get. And my mother was the same way. She came out of a large family in Maryland. So they just, I didn't come out of a family. They would sit down and talk to us about issues. We would rarely would we have a conversation about family issues. It just didn't happen. There was no I love yous, never any I love yous. Rarely was there a hug at all. And because they didn't get it, they just didn't know how to pass that on. And I understand that today, but I think I grew up with some anger and resentments that would later on show up in the step work. But we just didn't do that kind of conversating and talking. And but they would do stuff like my father would send me down to North Carolina to work tobacco. Now I was born in Washington, D.C. He would send me down to North Carolina to work tobacco. And that was some hard work. I think they thought they were going to work some of that, some of my problems out of me, you know. And I'm going to tell you something. I hated going down there. I hated going down there. But I love going down there now. Just like I love coming out here. I love the country. I love it. But I hated going down there then. And they would do stuff like, and my father tried to get me into the Boy Scouts. But I wasn't going to walk through my neighborhood with a Boy Scout uniform, boy. I just wasn't going to do it. And I liked some of the stuff that they were doing, but I just wasn't going to walk through my day. Because by this time, I'm hanging in alleys gambling. I'm not drinking, but I'm gambling. I'm getting caught up in a lifestyle. But what happened with me was towards the end, it got so bad that I knew I was going to have to stop or I was going to die. It was just the way that I was drinking and the amount of alcohol that I would drink. I'd done a lot of other stuff, but alcohol was always there. And see, one of my problems, too, is I just never asked for help. I never asked for help. My famous words are, I'm all right. No matter how bad I'm doing, I tell you, I'm all right. And I reached that point where I knew I was going to have to stop or I was going to die. So I said, I'm going to stop, but I'm going to do it by myself. And I'll never forget this day. I was just going through, man, I was going through the DTs and I'm a praying drunk. You know, I'm a praying drunk. Whenever I'm in trouble, I'm always calling, God help me, God help me. I ain't going to do it no more. God help me. As soon as I get out of that situation, I go right back and do the same thing. But this time, I mean, I was on my knees praying, and I'm really not a church person, but there was a Bible in the house, and I remember grabbing the Bible, walking around with it, because I was going through so much pain, and I just kept telling myself, I can just get through this day, I'll be all right. And I remember my mother called me, and I'll never forget it. I could hardly hold a phone in my hand, and I told her, she said, how you doing? I said, I'm all right, I'm all right. I made it through that day, and the next day came, I was still sick, and I knew I was going to drink. I knew I was going to drink, and I knew I would need some help. So I started making some phone calls before I took the drink, and that's when I got the number to Men's Detox. And again, thank God for Men's Detox. So I drank. Eventually, I got into detox. They told me to come on in. Detox back then, like I said, it was just a place where, you know, they brought you where you were drunk on the street. Years ago, all you had to do, the only requirement to get in there was to be drunk. That was the only requirement. It was just to be, they didn't care if you had ID. They didn't care if you had insurance. They didn't care nothing about nowadays. They wanted to know your insurance, you got ID, they went on all that stuff. But back then, you just had to be drunk. You didn't have to know how to sign your name because most folks going in there shaking. So just put a mark right there on that piece of paper right there. And I went in there like I normally do, talking stuff because I'm drunk. So I'm talking trash. And I remember the guy, he said, just go on back in the room back there. And I went on in that back room. And I remember I slept that drunk off. And when I woke up and I realized where I was at. I'm going to tell you, I took a meeting to detox over 30-some years. That was one of the best commitments that I had. You know, they talked about it this morning, getting a commitment. The man that helped me, he said, get you some commitments because they help nail you down. And one of the reasons I took that commitment to detox is because they had an AA meeting every night. And I was just going to stay in detox long enough to get through the DTs, and then I was going to do this thing by myself. And I know without a doubt, had I left up out of there, I would have drank again. There's no doubt in my mind about it because my illness went beyond just the alcohol. And so I went to the AA meetings, and it was just something about the way that those guys looked. The image that I had in my mind of AA, I remember seeing this movie called The Days of Wine and Roll. I won't watch this movie today. I thought it was one of the most depressive movies I ever saw with Jack Lemmon. So I had this image in my mind that I'd be mad about not drinking. I'd be fighting it. And these guys had a lot of joy and laughter. And the big book says if the newcomer could see no joy in this thing, they wouldn't want it. And they seemed to have a freedom about themselves, and they would talk about things that I would never admit to. And they had the ability to laugh at themselves, and I came off them corners where we would never laugh at ourselves. We laugh at other people. But while I was in detox, there was a man running detox at that time named Mr. Branch. Mr. Branch wasn't an alcoholic. But I think about him the same way as Dr. Silkworth. They weren't alcoholics, but they went the extra mile. He didn't have to do for me what he did for me. And what he did, he pulled me into his office and started asking me some questions. And he seemed like he was really interested in my situation. And he was one of the first people that I got honest with about my drinking. Because the impulse in the beginning, because I mean, I was at a state where I would just lie automatically. Every time my mouth would, lies would just start coming out. Especially if you ask me questions about my drinking. But it was something about the way that he was talking to me and the fact that I was in detox. Because I was going to say, well, look, man, I just drink a couple of beers. You know, but I knew you don't come to a place like this just drink a couple of beers. And then the thought ran through my head that if you want some help, you got to stop lying. And so I got honest with him. He just asked me some basic questions. And, you know, I really thought that he was giving me some special treatment until I got to where he sent me, which is St. Elizabeth's Hospital. And then I found out he treated everybody like that, you know. But I got honest with him. I said, he didn't have any questions about my drink. I said I was drinking about a fifth or more a day or whatever I could get. It didn't matter what it was. Told him I hadn't worked in a couple of years. I told him I had a son. I wasn't doing anything for him. And at the end of the conversation, he told me that I was a sick young man. And he suggested I go to St. Elizabeth's Hospital. And I'll never forget what he said. He said it's one of the best programs on the East Coast. And I often laugh about that. You know, he was sending me to the nut house. But he sent me to one of the best programs on the East Coast. St. E's back in the day was under the federal government. Got a lot of help. I stayed at detox 9 days waiting for them to get me a bed over at St. Elizabeth's Hospital. Most of the guys that were bringing the meeting were from either the Metropolis Club or the St. E's group. And when they took me over to St. Elizabeth's Hospital, and they took me directly there. They didn't give me no tokens to catch the bus. They took me directly there. And I remember by this time, I'm a little physically better. Because I was a young guy. I bounced back. And the guy that was taking me over, they said, well, look, you want a dollar for a pack of cigarettes? And I was smoking back then. I was smoking a pack a day. But that false pride kicked in, and I said, nah, man, I don't need no dollar. Now, he knew I didn't have no money. He knew I'd been in detox 9 days. I didn't have any money. I wanted that dollar, but that false pride, I didn't want him to know I didn't have a dollar. But anyway, they took me over to St. Elizabeth's Hospital. That's where I met the man that was to help me the most, Mom McCaskill. He's dead now. That man helped me a lot. And he was a counselor. He came down to admissions. And I came in there telling her, I said, now back then treatment was long term, a year to 2 years. I ended up staying there a year, best year of my life, but I never want to have to go through that experience again. But when I first talked to him, I said, well, look, man, I only want to be here 90 days. He got up and started walking out. And he said, look, go to RCA. RCA was a place down in Occoquan, Virginia, you could go down there and a lot of guys were going there. We used to take a meeting down there, too. And I took a lot of meetings at institutions. I still do. But it was just something about the way he did that. That let me know that was some serious business. See, I thought that once I let them know I'm going to stop drinking and I'm coming into the program, they're supposed to swing wide the gates and bang the drum because I want to get sober. And what they let us know was say, man, we ain't sending for you. We ain't sending for you. And what happened was, I think I called Branch back with something new for me. I called him, and he said, look, you don't go over there telling them people how long you want to stay. If you don't want to leave, if you don't want to stay there after night, you can leave, but don't go over there telling them. So I went and called Marv back, and what they did, I think, for them to check my motivation, they put me in what they call a general admissions unit in St. Eve. The St. Eve is the old hospital. It was one of them 100, and they had about 100 and some buildings over there. We used to have a joke. We used to say they put the real sick people on the Alabama Avenue side of St. E's. That's where they put me. No fixed address. And they put me on this general admissions unit. And these guys were deformed. They couldn't talk. I mean, they were, you know, going off. And, I mean, it was something I'd never seen before. And I remember some of them, and I was watching what was going on in there. And sometimes, you know, some of them walking around like they're real bad. I mean, good and crazy. I mean, and some of them would just haul off and hit somebody, right? And all they would do is throw them into seclusion. Now, they go in there kicking and screaming. They throw them in seclusion, hit them with that Thorazine, and they come out looking like a zombie. And I said, that looked like some good stuff right there. That, you know? But one of the guys, he said, nah, man, you don't want none of that stuff. So I started walking around with a pool ball in my hand. I said, if somebody hit me, we're going to fight up in here. But what happened was I talked to a psychiatrist. Psychiatrist was asking me questions like what year it is, who's the president. I was so scared I might miss one of them questions. Because I said, if you don't know what year it is or who's the president, they might keep me on this lock ward the rest of my life. But what they did, they went ahead and put me on the alcohol unit, and that's when my life really started to get transformed and started to change. They helped me to understand my illness. See, I thought, and I went in there thinking, that if I could stop for a period of time, a year, 2 years, certainly by 3 years, I'd be cured and I'd be able to drink again. And they cut that off right from the start. They said, look, it doesn't matter how long you stop drinking. If you're an alcoholic, if you go back after any time, you're going to end up right back where you were or worse unless you come back in here. And what would happen is I came through with a lot of what we would call skid row bum directing traffic type drunks. And they would get physically better. And they used to say physical sobriety is one of the worst things that happened to us because we get better physically long before we get better mentally or spiritually. And like I said, I bounced back quick. I was young. I bounced back. But I would watch these guys, and they would be in the meeting, and we'd be talking good. They look good. And then they might go out on a pass, and they might take a drink. And I would see them in detox in a day or two, sometimes the very day, beat up. And I said, that's me. If I go back, the same thing is going to happen to me. But it was a profound thing for me to see that. Because I thought, when they said, eventually you're going to end up right back where you were, well, I was dealing with this kind of logic. Because that idea of just never drinking again just wasn't sitting too well. That's why they kept telling us, take it a day at a time. But I thought, okay, well, if I stop, though, for 2 or 3 years, it's going to take 2 or 3 years for that pain to come back. And no, it don't work like that. It just don't work like that. It's like you never stop. It's just like you never stop. And somewhere along the line, I started to want this thing. I know I didn't want that mental obsession to come back. They told us that we have an illness of the mind and body, a mental obsession and a physical allergy. That mental obsession was so strong in me. There would be times when I would tell myself, man, you need to leave this stuff alone. It's killing you. And in the next second, the thought would enter my mind, go get it. And once that thought entered my mind, I had to go get it. You know, I had to go. Now, if I could have just taken one drink, I might have gotten away with it. But then they say we have an illness of the body, too. They call it an allergy. Allergy is just an abnormal reaction to something. Some people just like, some people can drink. They can take one or two drinks and set it down. Not me. Once I take a drink, it triggers off the craving for more alcohol. And I'll drink till I end up drunk and all the other stuff that go with it. The blackouts, I was a blackout drinker. The loneliness, our literature says we're tortured by loneliness. I was a lonely drunk. And I'm one of them kind of fantasizing drunks. You know, I could get a bottle, go off in a park somewhere and start drinking that stuff, and I go off into a fantasy world. You know, I mean, really, I go way off into a fantasy world. In the beginning, I might start thinking about, well, if I can just give me a good woman or give me a job or get this or get that. Next thing you know, the more I keep drinking, I'm saving the world. You know, the more I keep drinking that stuff. And I couldn't stop. I just couldn't stop for me. And if I pick it up after 37 years, it's going to do the same thing, because I've seen them do it with all kind of time. I've seen them do it with all kind of time. I haven't seen not one person come in here and go back to drinking and their life got better. I just haven't seen it. And so what happened was I stayed there a year, and Marv said he thought one of the main reasons why people go back and they don't do a fourth and fifth step. I didn't know who I was. You know, my story is, and they said resentment was the number one offender. And I'm in the nut house thinking I don't have any resentment. I'm a nice guy. You know, see, my story is I'm in a nut house trying to act like I ain't a nut. You know what I mean? And when you in a nut house trying to act like, you know, you ain't a nut, you're going to be in there a little while. Cause, you know, they know you good and crazy, you know. So I'm sitting in there in Chinese back in the day. That it was a training hospital, so you saw a lot of psychologists, psychiatrists, they training on you. So I put on some clean Chinese clothes and go before them and try to act nice to them. And I wanted them to release me early. You know, I wanted them to say something nice about me you know, just tell me I can go on. Nothing. You're cured. You all right, ma'am. And what they would do, see, they would give us our charts. I guess they figured we just didn't know how to read or something, but they would give us our charts to take it over to the clinics or whatever. And I would read my chart, and they would put stuff in there like, he really doesn't know who he is, you know what I mean? But he was neat, but he really doesn't know who he was. And that was the thing, I really didn't know who I was. I didn't know who I was. So Marv said he thought one of the main reasons why people go back is they don't do a fourth and a fifth step. Now, the first job I got, they gave me a job making sandwiches in the canteen on the grounds. And it was a humbling experience. And, you know, I figured if I'm not drinking, I'm supposed to be running something. But I didn't have any skills to do anything, so they had me right where I was supposed to be. But what happened was on that job, in order for somebody to run that place, they had to be legally blind. And I overheard this lady talking about me one day. And what she said, she was talking to one of the employees, and she said, you know, that boy is crazy. And the reason why she said that was this. She knew, I went from one extreme to the other. Basically, I was a young bum when I got in there. But then I go to the other extreme where I don't have any emotions. I'm not getting mad. You know, I got to make the perfect sandwich. You know, I just felt like I had to be perfect. And that was a cover up that low self-esteem. I had low self-esteem. I didn't know that. But I was trying to cover it up. So she knew that you couldn't work in that kind of environment trying to act like you perfect. And what happened was she left and another guy came there. And they put me on the cash register. What happened was the money started coming up short. Now, by this time, I want this way of life. I don't want to go back. I don't want to drink because I know what will happen if I drink. So I stopped doing certain things like stealing. But the money was coming up short. And they told me, they said, now I wasn't the only one on the cash register. But she said, if the money comes up short again, we're going to put you back on that line making those sandwiches. And the money came up short. They put me on that line. And I didn't know how to handle my emotions. That's when that little boy, the scared little boy, came out. One of the customers just said something to me, and I went off. All that stuff that I've been suppressing. See, I'm one of the kind of guys they call a time bomb, pressure cooker. I stuff my feelings down, act like everything is all right, you know. But I didn't know how to handle my feelings, and I had a knife in my hand. I had a knife in my hand. I felt like God probably just said, could you put some mustard on my sandwich or something like that? And I just went off, you know. And but I was already on Chinese ground, so I just went on back to the ward and I talked to the people. I let them know. I knew enough to let people know what was going on with me. And they were doing some things to try to help me and get a better job and all of that. I got a GED in Chinese, and eventually, some 5 years later, I went to college and graduated with honors. For a guy like me to stay back in the second grade, you know, to be able to do that, that's all as a result of trying to give myself to this program and challenging those fears and doing some things that people told me to do. Like I said, when I left Chinese after that year, and I had this fear that because while I was in there, the obsession to drink was lifted. But I thought that it would come back once I left that protective environment. And that was the biggest fear that I had. And what happened was, but when I left, they told me the whole solution was just keep coming back. Stay connected. Stay connected. So I started taking that meeting to detox. Like I said, I did that meeting for over 30 years. That was one of the, I'd still be doing it. And it wasn't like I was just taking the meeting. I was made sure I always showed up because we got the spirit of rotation. So it wasn't like I was running it. But it was always important for me to go back to detox. And detox had moved a few times, and I used to always say they took the smell with them. It was important, for me to stay connected to that, to be reminded of where I came from. But I knew I would have to eventually start getting down to the causes and conditions. I did that four-step. I had my mother and father on the top of the list of that resentment piece. When I first got to St. E's, I did a lot of talking about my mother and father. And they said, man, look, your mother and father not in here. So you the one in the nut house, you need to start talking about you. And that's what I had to start doing. I had to start talking about my own feelings and my own emotions. And I remember I got into a relationship. You know how it is when you stop drinking and you won't fall in love. I fell in love in the nut house, you know. I'm in the nut house. And the man that helped me, Marv, he used to see me on the phone all the time. And Marv used to ease up beside me and say, now look, before you get married, call me. See, he knew I'm one of these kind of guys with that low self-esteem. All it took was one of them little girls to say they like me or love me. You know, I'm all in love, male, you know what I mean. And but I remember what happened. It was about after 3 years, she told me, she said, now look, if you got to keep going to the meetings, you know, I can always find somebody else to be with me. And that thing shook me up. And I remember I was leaving the Metropolis Club, and I said, well, I'm going to go over there. I'm going to surprise her. And when I got over there, I was surprised. She ain't waste no time. You know what I mean? And there was another guy there. Now, I was a fighting drunk. You know, I get drunk, get into fights, that kind of thing. But since I've been sober, I haven't gotten into one physical fight. But I came close that night. I was so hurt. I mean, it was hurtful. And and I actually chased this guy. I mean, thank God I ain't catch him, but I was so hurt. And but because I had been putting something in, I just went back and talked to some people. That's what I learned. You're going through something, you got to talk to people now. And because I'm a guy that wouldn't get honest with anybody. And I remember talking to one of the old times, old Al Wood. He done passed on now. Al told me something that always stays with me. He said, if you give people that much power to make you feel good, then you give them that much power to make you feel bad. It's just part of growing up in recovery. And since that time, I've gone through all kinds of situations, you know, all deaths in the family, relationships changes, job changes, tragedies. But I haven't had to drink. I didn't even want to drink then. I just thought I was going to lose my mind. But I didn't really want to drink. As long as I don't drink, I got a shot. When they said it was a spiritual program, and in the beginning, Ma said, for guys like you and me that might have a problem with the God thing, just use the group's higher power until you can develop that relationship with God. And but I knew I wanted to develop a relationship with God. And what happened was I wanted to start praying when I was in Chinese, but I didn't want to get down on my knees in that dormitory and pray. Because I thought praying was a sign of weakness. And I thought they would look at it like that. And I said, you know, that's your problem. You're always worrying about what other people think. So I got down on my knees then, and I've been consistent with that. Just like I did today, every day. Prayer and meditation every day for me. But I started praying there at St. Eve's. I say the third step prayer, seventh step prayer. My prayer life has increased over the years. They tell us that we can expand it. And that's what I try to do today. But in the beginning, it was just some simple praise. Just God, help me get through this day. Help me to stay alcohol free. And thank him at night on my knees, which I still do that. Thank him on my knees. But again, I had to get down to the cause and conditions. Look at those resentments. Look at those fears. Look at my sex conduct. And, you know, then I had to talk to somebody about that stuff. And I'm a guy that wouldn't get honest with someone. I didn't really want to do that, you know, hold on to my feelings. But the value of that fifth step, because they tell us that a solitary self-appraisal isn't enough. I could only look as far as I could look. I had to talk to somebody else so they could help me see some other things. And what I got out of that experience was they helped me to see how I was holding on to some deep-seated resentments. It's the number one offender for me. I inventory them every day. Got to look at it all during the day, but at the end of the day, I got to look at it again. You know. In the sixth and seventh step, they talked about their instincts. Instincts that far exceed their proper function. That's why I'm going to always have some defects of character. You know. But now I got some tools that I can use to help me get through any situation. In the 12 and 12, they describe me. The 12 and 12 talks about we actually get a perverse satisfaction out of people annoying us. Because then we can get that self-righteous, that's me, that self-righteous anger. I get on the job, supervisor say something, who you think you're talking to? You know? Don't you know who I am? I wouldn't say this out loud. I come out of St. Elizabeth's Hospital, man, you talking to me like that. But you know, that's that self, I get a charge, I get, you know, fired up. I get fired up. But all of those defects, it's usually some kind of pleasure I'm getting out of. That's why I'm not always willing to let it go. But now I see how they're going to hurt me in the long run, so I'm far more willing to have it removed today. And so that's why I make that seventh-step prayer. That's part of my prayer routine on a daily basis. The eighth step was an important step for me. That was an important step because I wanted to make amends to my mother and father who were at the top of the list. They were the hardest ones for me to go to because, like I said, I came out of a family. We just didn't have those kind of conversations. But I knew, and what I'd done, it had gotten better where, because prior to coming in here, my parents would have their pajamas on, but they'd have their money with them at all times. They couldn't put their money down. And, you know, I robbed them not only of their possessions, but the emotional security, you know, I was the only son. And anytime you can't feel comfortable in your own house, you know, that's why they wanted me to be put away. But they were the hardest ones for me to make amends to. But through talking to someone else who helped me to understand, and in the eighth step, it says very deep, sometimes quite forgotten, damaging emotional conflicts persist below the level of conscience. That's in the literature. And I believe that was what was going on with me. I couldn't see what was preventing me from making the amends. But through talking to somebody, they helped me to see how I was just holding on to some deep-seated resentments. And I remember when I did muster up the courage and go to my mother and talk to her. And, you know, I was telling about all the stuff that I'd done. And she was saying, yeah, you did all of that. And I guess I was waiting for her to admit her part or, you know, but our program said we got to clean up our side of the street. But I could see that's what I was looking for, some kind of connection. And I'm going to tell you, I went to both my mother and my father separately, and that's probably one of the most rewarding things that I've done since I've been in recovery. And I could kind of relate to Joyce when she talked about how her relationship with her, not just her father had improved, but with males. Well, with me, I think I was able to kind of reach out to people more. I'd gotten so I could let you come to me, but I wasn't doing a whole lot of reaching out to you. And that's what it helped me to do, kind of reach out to other people. It was one of the most rewarding experiences that I had. I had to clean up some other stuff, child support, all that stuff. But But at the end of that, at the end of the ninth step, and they talked about it today, they got the 14 promises. And there's this old time, he always says, oh, Harold G said, he said, we painstaking about this phase of our development, we'll be amazed before we're halfway through. He said he was sharing that at a meeting one time. And he said a newcomer came up to him. He said, well, how do you know when you're halfway through? He said, well, are you amazed? He said, no. He said, well, you ain't halfway through. I'm amazed, and the steps are just so important in my life today. The 10th step is extremely important. I'll tell you why. There was a friend of mine who came through Sinai with me. Man, we walked this thing. You know, they sometimes tell you, get your buddy in AA. And he was my man. We slept side by side in Sinai's. When I got out of the hospital, and see, back in the day, you know, we didn't have employment histories and histories on a place to stay. And they told me, they said, look, a guy like you, you need to get your own place. You need to start being responsible. You need to take care of yourself. And so what they would do back when I was coming through, the older people or the people who had gone before me, they would help us to get into a place. And that's what this guy did for me. I got into this little efficiency apartment where I was a stay for a good while. It was the first time I'd been on my own. It taught me some lessons that have helped me today, how to be responsible. But we kind of walked this path. But he went back after 33 years. He went back after 33 years. And that's when I started paying attention to that part in the 10th step where it says it's easy to let up on a spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. It says, but we are in trouble if we do, because alcohol is a subtle foe. So we're not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve, contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. But I paid attention to that part where it says, it's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action. When he went back, now I was in a meeting, and I got a phone call while I was in the meeting. And he actually had tried to, and I'm just telling the story, you know, I'm not going to say his name, he's a friend of mine, but I think I'll just share it because it might help somebody. But he had tried to kill himself even before that had happened. And, you know, Bill Wilson wrote that piece on emotional sobriety when he had about 24 years of recovery. Bill Wilson suffered from depression terribly. And he talked about in emotional sobriety, if you haven't read that piece, you should read that. He talked about how that depression almost took him to the cleaners, you know. And so my man had tried to kill himself even before he drank. But it didn't happen. He got a little help. But for some reason, he decided to take a drink. And when I got that phone call, somebody told me, they said, well, he called somebody and said that what he had done and that he was going to kill himself. So I knew to take it seriously. So I went over the way he was staying. He had just moved in the spot. And the lady didn't want to let us in there for some reason. She said, it was a policy. I can't let you in there and all this kind of stuff. So we trying to explain to her what's going on. She finally called the police and the ambulance came. And they were wheeling him out. You know, I saw this big hole in his chest. He tried to stab himself several times in the heart. It's a serious illness that we have. Serious illness. Bill Wilson said that when it comes to alcohol, we were strangely insane. He said, we're not just insane, we strangely insane. And I think the strange part is that when we don't drink, we look like we all right. You know, when I look out there, y'all look like y'all all right. But if you like me, you know, there's some stuff going on, you know. But when I saw that happen to my man, I mean, that's when I really started. Now, I didn't get scared it was going to happen to me because I was plugged in. He wasn't as plugged in, you know. He wasn't as plugged in. One of the things that I like that it says in the 10th step, and this has been my experience, I share this a lot when I go into the jail, take a meeting to the D.C. jail. And I share this experience. They say that by this time, sanity will have returned. He says when it comes to alcohol, we react sanely. I'm not sane in a lot of other areas, but with alcohol, say we react sanely. It says, if tempted, we'll recall as if from a hot flame. And we find that this has happened automatically. So we're not fighting it. They call it a miracle. I call it a miracle myself. At one point, I'm fighting to not drink, and it wouldn't work. I come in here and try to follow a few simple principles, and I'm not thinking about it. That's the thing that makes me believe in God more than anything else. You know, and this is, they say this is how we will react so long as we stay in fit spiritual condition. So that's why prayer and meditation every day for a guy like me. I used to try to meditate early in my sobriety. I would hear people talk about the benefits of meditation, you know, sitting still. And I used to try to sit still early in my sobriety. Man, I'm going to tell you, well, I would be in the house. Nobody's in the house. And I would try to sit there and be quiet. And the more I would sit there and be quiet, the louder the noise in my head would get. I'm telling you, it would get loud. And then I just think about something somebody did to me. And I cuss them out, you know, all loud. Nobody, that no good, I ought to kill him. You know what I mean? But I could see what insanity was. Sanity is not out there. The sanity is right up in here. I could see that. And that's why I needed to do a little more house cleaning. The book says self-examination, prayer, and meditation. They say taken separately, each of these will bring some relief and benefit. But when they are logically related and interwoven, they'll form an unshakable foundation. And that's what I wanted, an unshakable foundation. So when I do the inventory, I see where I fall short. I see where I'm falling short. Then I got to pray. I got to ask God to help me with my defects of character. Then the meditation is being still and listening for the guidance. The guidance will come. They tell us that in the 11th step. The guidance will come. You know, eventually. It may not come the way I want it to come, but the guidance is going to come. So that's why I would no one do without prayer and meditation. Then the literature says air, food, or sunshine. I've learned to sit there, and if you sit there long enough, the mind will get quiet. You know, I don't have to run from these defects anymore. You know, I kind of use that example. You know, coming up, you know, I had my own room. I was scared. You know, fear was a big part of my life. And you know how people scare you sometimes, you know, if you don't do the right thing, something going to get you and all that kind of stuff. And I would go into my room and, you know, in the darkness, I think something in there. And but when you turn the light on, there's nothing there. Well, that's how I kind of look at the prayer, meditation. It's just like shining the light on these defects of character. And when you shine a light on those defects, they lose their power. They just tend to lose their power. It's just when I get so caught up in it, that's when I, you know, get thrown off. But when I stay close to the program, those defects tend to lose their power. So that's why, as we'll say, it's 10, 11, and 12 are daily for me. I remember the other day, me and a friend, we were riding, and a lady cut me off, and right away, automatically, I said something in the car, called her name. Didn't say it to her, but I said it in the car. She said, well, what step are you working on? But I immediately shot back. I said, I'm working on a 10th step. I said, because number one, I didn't slow down, you know, because the lady didn't even know she cut me off. I didn't slow down and let her know she cut me off. I didn't say nothing to her. So what I'm saying is that I fall short. I fall short. I still get angry. I still get scared. But I got some tools that'll kind of bring me back in line, you know. And I get there a little quicker if I'm willing to work them. Sometimes I'm not always willing. Sometimes. But by doing some things on a daily basis. And that's why that day at a time piece is so important for me. In the beginning, it was not drinking a day at a time. But the day, if I can just stay in today, and they talked about it today, if I can just stay in the here and now, everything is all right. Here and now, everything is all right. You know, when I do the 11th step at night, when I review my day, I ask myself, were you resentful, selfish, dishonest, afraid? Do you owe an apology? Have you kept something to yourself which should be discussed with another person at once? Were you kind and loving towards all? But the main one I like is, how could you have handled it better? And usually for me, if I can just stay in the moment or stay in the here and there, I'm all right. It's just when I start thinking about what happened in the past, yesterday, or something in the past, or worrying about what's going to happen in the future, you know, that's what messes me up right there. I tried to get this thing back. You know, I was taught that early. They said you got to be willing to go to any length. Matter of fact, they get in the same. They used to ask you this question. They say, how bad do you want it, and what length are you willing to go? Everybody always say, I'm willing to go to any length. But at some point, you got to really live up to that. And that's why one of the things that I grabbed on to when I first came in, they say, if you're willing to put as much into your recovery as you did into your drinking, then there's no way that you'll be sober. I'm a guy that gave my whole self to alcohol, so that meant that I have to be willing to put forth that same effort in my recovery. And I made a commitment to myself that whenever I'm asked to do anything in this fellowship, I'm going to try my best to do it, because I would never turn down a drink. And since I've been here, I've really tried to live up to that. It's helped me to stay connected, to meet people. They tell us in our book, let me tell you this part. I think I might have told this story the last time I was down here. But whenever I'm asked, you know, I go. That's my responsibility. But this story came out of the grapevine. These two old times, a little humorous story. These two old times were talking at the end of the meeting, you know, meeting after the meeting. Joe and Tom, and Joe said, Tom, do you think there's AA in heaven? And Tom said, you know, I don't know, but let's make a pact that whoever dies first, he's going to come back and tell the other one if there's AA in heaven. And sure enough, Tom passed away a few months later. And while Joe was sleeping, Tom appeared to him in his sleep. And Joe said, Tom, is that you? Tom said, yeah, it's me. He said, well, is there AA in heaven? He said, well, I got good news and I got bad news. The good news is, yes, there's AA in heaven. The bad news is, you the speaker for next Saturday. So, whatever we ask, we got to go. I was told to do that, that whenever I'm asked, to be willing to give this thing back. I take a meeting into D.C. jail. There might be 60 guys there. And it's a profound thing, because most of them, you know, most of them have been in the AA before, some 12-step program. So I always ask them, I say, how many people been in AA or NA, you know? Most of the hands go up. Because it's a profound thing when they're reading How It Works, you know, they hear all these men, you know, and they some of them exaggerating it, but, you know, so they hear them recite the 12 steps. And then I say, but how many people have gone through all 12 steps? And not a hand ever goes up. Not a hand goes up. And that's what I say was in How It Works, that rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. So that's why I try to bring that message in there now. You know, try to get through that process, you know, the step process. You know, that's what's transformed my life. I'm living good. I mean, I'm living good. I can't tell you about the blessings that have come to me. I was able to retire, you know, about 5-6 years ago. I got some other stuff that I do. Landlord. That's why I really got to add some 12 steps, you know what I mean? But I'm living good, you know. I can pretty much go where I want to go. I have a certain amount of freedom. But the most important thing is I got to be willing to give this thing back. They said nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with another alcoholic. They say that'll work when other activities fail. They say life will take on new meaning. That's the theme of this event right here. Life will take on new meaning. And that's when you watch newcomers come in and you see the light begin to come on. They say this is something frequent contact with a newcomer and each other is the bright spot of our lives. You know, out of all the stuff I might have, that's the bright spot of my life. Is when I'm willing to pass this thing on. And when you watch other people come in and you see them grow in recovery, that's a beautiful thing to watch. You know, so I want to thank Billy again for asking me to come down. It's been a real good event for me. And I learned a lot. You know, I always want to be teachable. I ain't got it made. One of the old times that came out of St. E, she started the women's meet. She said, ain't none of us got it made. She said, the only ones that got it made are the ones that die sober. That's how I want to go, sober. Thank you.